So, hey, it's Lisa from the Albany Pet Services podcast. I'm really delighted to be here with Monique Ferrier-Clyde today. Monique co-authored a book that is wonderful called Cooperative Veterinary Care. It's got lots and lots of tips about how you can train your pets to cooperate in their own care and therefore reduce their stress. And fear as well, and as it also gives advice to vets to make their practices more friendly as well, all through preparation, planning and training. So it uses positive reinforcement training in the book as well. So how are you today, Monique?
I'm doing just fine. It is 80 degrees today in Seattle, theoretically. Oh. So we're all feeling happy and the sun is out and it's good.
It's really hot in here in England as well. We're having a mini heat wave. It's 30 degrees.
Whew.
So yeah, we're not used to it. So yeah, all the dogs are being walked really early or really late at night. I don't see many dogs out and about, so that's really good. Great. So what inspired you to write the book? Because it is a big book. It's really comprehensive and clear to understand. But what kind of inspired you to write it with Alicia?
You know, the thing that I think really prompted the project was we both had been doing a lot of training with clients and a lot of training with like veterinary teams and putting out a lot of one-off content where we'd reach a smaller audience. But it became more and more evident, like the more we taught and the more clients we interacted with and the more vet teams we interacted with, it was clear that people really wanted this information and it would be super helpful to have it in a more widely available format. And we had been talking to Wiley, the publisher, about just general book projects from a VTS behavior, because they were looking to add some behavior titles to their library. And that's sort of how it was born, as we knew that there was a need and the publisher wanted a behavior title. And so that's the one that we ended up picking.
Brilliant. That's cool. How do you find owners and vets as well actually respond to the idea of training for care? So I know sometimes there's the idea that things can take time and we've all got busy lives. Do you find that people are maybe proactive in training, and that if they got an awareness, do you think maybe now more than before of preventative care and training? Or do you think it's more of a kind of reactive response? If that's quite a question, really.
I think it's a little bit of, I think I know what you're asking. I think it's a little bit of both. So as the awareness grows that there might be more than one right way to provide veterinary care, people are opening their minds to more than one option. And like the fear-free movement really is something that increased visibility about issues like this. And, you know, a lot of us grew up with Sophia Yin and low stress handling, and then Fear Free became available. And it was a way that brought a lot of professionals who had all been doing really similar things, but all sort of at the individual level together into a cohesive group. And that cohesive group really has a lot of ability to reach more and more people. And you get this sort of group think happening where at the professional level, people are opening their minds to doing things different. And when we, you know, the book for us really was coming from the veterinary professional standpoint. Like we wrote it in the format of a textbook with the intent that the primary audience is veterinary professionals and that the primary audience is veterinary professionals who have never trained before.
Is so that it's your really veterinary?
Yes. So Alisa and I are both veterinary technician specialists in behavior. So I've been in small animal clinical practice for in excess of 25 years, which is just a long time, but that's what really informs the level of training that's in the book, because both of us have that behavior background and just really strong training chops, but also long careers working floor shifts in veterinary medicine. And mm-hmm. I think it gives us a really unique perspective as teachers and instructors, because we know all of the teeny tiny little pieces that are clinically relevant to every procedure. And I think mm-hmm. that's actually the piece that's missing a lot of the time when like owners try to train at home and they do their very best to prepare their animal for a specific procedure, but they might not have all the clinical information that they need to make their training real life enough. And so then when you try to actually do the procedure, there's a surprise in there for the animal because the training plan was incomplete.
Could you give an example of that? Thing.
Oh, certainly. So say for instance, if people are teaching a blood collection is a really common thing that people try to treat, especially or try to train, especially like trainer owners, like people who are pet owners, but also are trainers. And they kind of want to get going down this road of cooperative care with their own pets before they start working with clients. Uh-huh. Blood draw is one of the most popular things that people try. Yeah. And so they will train the pet how to present their leg, and they might train them how to have the vein held off. And then they might introduce something like a syringe to do a mock-up blood collection.
Uh-huh.
But they might not know how to put pressure and where on the limb so that the vein stands up.
Right. Okay.
Which is a constricting feeling around the animal's leg. And it's at the beginning of the process. And so the animal presents their leg, and then the vet tech goes to constrict pressure around the leg. The animal wasn't expecting that. And it is off-putting for them because they didn't know what was going to happen. And it's a constrictive pressure, and it can blow up the whole idea. And so then the poor trainer owner is like, I trained this awesome blood draw behavior, and then I went to the vet and everything fell apart. And it's because they didn't have the hold off piece, or maybe they didn't have the alcohol piece. And the vet tech went to put alcohol on the fur, and the odor and that cold liquid sensation was really off-putting for the pet. And they just didn't have quite enough information for how to fully train that behavior.
Sure. So that's really, handy. It's not just as simple as, you know, here's my paw.
Right.
Blood draw. It's all the different things. Yeah.
All those little pieces really come together to build a robust behavior. So the specificity of it is really helpful and important. The other thing is the opposite end of the spectrum. So the thing we just talked about is a very specific trained behavior. Like let's train a really fancy trained blood draw with all of the tiny bells and whistles so that it really goes. But the flip side to that is really conditioning animals to be comfortable with the unexpected and the unknown.
Mm.
Here's how you tell me that you're ready for some kind of handling, but it's maybe a surprise to you what that handling is. And putting together a training program for these animals so that they are accepting and trusting for things that they might not know what the outcome is.
Yeah.
Builds this sort of resilience, and it gets you a lot of sort of emotional capital on the part of the animal that they show up to the table with, that they can, that then you can, you know, make a withdrawal on that emotional capital as you need to through your work with them. Mm. And it's funny because it's, I tell my clients all the time, I'll say, I'm a really proficient trainer, but you're going to see me do a lot of sloppy training on your animal right now. And here's why. What I need your animal to do is to be able to accept the unexpected and to accept variety. Sure. Which is the opposite of conventional training, where we're putting in all of these very specific cues. When my hand has this with one finger or two fingers, or facing you or facing me, or, you know, sit versus stand versus down versus recall versus wait. We tend to be super precise in our cueing when we're training specific behaviors. This is a different kind of conditioning process where I also want them to be able to accept things that aren't that specific, but know that the context means that it's going to be relatively brief and that they can trust that it's going to be okay.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. As well, in a veterinary environment, it's not a home environment. There's different smells, different sounds of the other animals, the pheromones, and everything that's happening in a vet environment is very different to what's happening at home as well.
And I mean, you consider even, you know, novice pet owners who will sign up for puppy class, for instance, to say, oh, well, I don't need beginner puppy class because my puppy always already knows how to come when I call it. But they have an 8-week-old puppy, and all 8-week-old puppies follow you around all the time, no matter what. It's a normal developmental stage. And then they, you know, take their puppy out into the world when it's 12 weeks old, and they call the puppy and it can't come. And that's a really basic example of how environment and development change the behavior of the animal in a way that the owners, especially if they are novice owners, did not anticipate, predict, or prepare for. Mm-hmm. And so your point about environment is really valid. And we generally encourage people to try and develop a relationship with their veterinary office so that they can come in and actually train periodically. They'll have to pay for an exam room time usually to be able to do that and practice. Mm-hmm. Go in, get on the scale, go in the exam room, lay down on your mat, pretend to get your shot, get a cookie, go home.
Yeah.
Just like you would practice loose leash walking on a walk versus just in the yard or in the kitchen.
Yeah.
It's the same idea. Or if people who do agility or fly ball, they're not going to only do that in the backyard. Or there's a whole lot of steps to get them ready to be able to go to a show and work in that different environment.
Yeah.
Cooperative veterinary care is the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. What kind of things do you think an owner should, if they want to think about cooperative veterinary care, what kind of things do you think would be kind of staples? So in the same way, if they go to puppy class, probably want their puppy to learn to drop, leave things, socialize, and come back reliably when they're called.
Sure. It's like, what's the puppy punch list or kitten punch list?
Yeah. And the kitten punch list. Yeah. Because I think that's really important as well. Talking about cats and kittens.
Yep.
A lot of cats and kittens don't like being handled. Maybe that, because they've obviously got that shorter socialization period. Mm-hmm. And they might not have pad handling. So yeah, cooperative care for cats. People say you can't train cats, but I've seen your Facebook group and videos, and I've seen some amazing videos of cats getting blood draws and cats opening or closing the door to their carriers, which is just amazing. So yeah, let's talk about cats as well.
cats are wonderful, and they're super smart. Cats get a little bit of a bad rap, like social media and the press, like they are just sort of, you know, we're here to sort of serve cats, or we have this like weird different relationship with cats. And we do have a unique pet owning relationship with cats. Like, they're not co-evolved in the same way as dogs, but certainly the level of companionship that we can have and the training relationship that we can have with cats is just as awesome as it is with dogs.
Yeah.
But we have to remember a few things about cats, which is that they eat a little bit more slowly. So if we're using food, we need to be ready to wait between repetitions for the cat to actually be able to consume its food. The timing feels very different when you're cat training than when you're dog training. Mm-hmm. Cats, excuse me, I need to sneeze.
Sure. Bless you.
Sorry about that. Mm-hmm. And cats also, they reach satiety faster. So usually we have a certain amount of training capital that we can do in any given session with any given pet. And they're going to be able to do a certain number of repetitions for a certain amount of food or a certain amount of play before they are satiated. And cats reach satiety faster than dogs most of the time. So they're going to want shorter training sessions with high value food. And we need to allow enough time between repetitions for them to be ready to restart. And that circle or that training loop, the timing will just feel really different when it is a cat versus a dog, but the outcome is often very similar. And it's just like any working with any animal, understanding that we have to set up the environment so they can be successful. Mm-hmm. So low enough distractions, high feelings of safety, high feelings of good emotional history, so that they are in a good emotional state. We want to understand what motivates cats, just like we understand what motivates dogs or chickens or any other animals that we're training with. And it's going to be different based on the individual. One of the things that we talk about in the book, and one of the things that's going to get updated in the second edition that's coming out, is just more carefully evaluating what each individual prefers. And we talk about it a fair amount in the first edition, but we're going to do some refinements because I've gotten a lot of feedback from people that they would really like more information about how to more carefully evaluate the motivation and reinforcement preferences for every individual pet. Because if we don't know how to motivate and we don't know how to reward, that makes it very challenging to train, especially when we're trying to train for things that they might not like. I can never make a needle not a needle. There's nothing I can do. There's going to be some amount of ick factor for a pet when I'm doing a veterinary procedure. There's so it makes it even more important for me to understand their motivation and their reward preferences. Yeah,
that's brilliant.
Because I gotta really make it worth their while, you know.
Yeah. Not a one size fits all approach, because what might be motivating for me in a job, say, might not be motivating for someone else.
Absolutely. You know, it's you know, some people like chocolate ice cream, and some people like strawberry ice cream, and some people like vanilla ice cream, and some people hate all ice cream.
Yeah.
And if somebody hates ice cream and I'm like, hey, how about some chocolate ice cream? If you vacuum in the living room, they're going to be like, yeah, I don't actually need to do that. But they're like, thanks. For, it was a great conversation. And the same thing is true for animals. We just have to evaluate them a little bit differently since they can't talk to us. But, you know, you were asking about puppies and kittens. I happen to have a new 8-week-old puppy right now, and I'm going to be documenting quite a lot of his training to update the videos for the second edition of the book, because we're going to replace quite a lot of the videos. And I'm going to try and document a fair amount of his training, because he's getting started with comfort with handling of his body, how to say yes, how to say no. Those are really the places that I start with young puppies and young kittens, is just making sure that we and in the book, we tried really hard to provide a lot of education about body language. Since pets communicate with us through body language, we need people, veterinary professionals, animal trainers, pet owners, to be able to evaluate, is their animal comfortable or not? And if the animal is comfortable, that's sort of the green light and you can keep working. And if the animal starts to look mildly uncomfortable, we need to give them a break and change something about how we're presenting the training puzzle. And that's going to be the first steps that I do with this puppy as well, is introducing the training puzzle to him and making sure that I'm paying a lot of attention to his body language, so that I'm teaching him, when he is ready, I will go. And if he is uncomfortable, I will pause and I will make a better plan that suits him on that day.
That's great, because they'll even, like, pets will stick around for food even if they feel uncomfortable in some circumstances, won't they? So being
exactly
hot on body language is imperative.
And you know what, you know, I just mentioned about how to say I'm ready and how to say I'm not ready, or how to say yes and how to say no. My job as the trainer and the educator is to listen to that, of course, body language, but also to reward the animal for communicating with me. So you'll see a lot of videos where, and I'm guilty of this too, a lot of the videos in the first edition, they really show a progression of successful approximations, because there's a time limit. And so I might have 5 training sessions compressed into a single video to show, like, here are all of the approximations. But what I'm finding is that people misinterpreted that that is everything that is a training session.
Right.
So, like, the bits that were cut out, they didn't perceive that I had cut bits out for time. And it's really important that if an animal opts out when they are uncomfortable, that we reward them every time. They need to get rewarded for opting out, just like they get rewarded for opting in, because I want that communication to stay present and fluid. You know, if an animal feels compelled to stay, or like they don't have a choice because they really, really want what you have. If I have a really high value food item, it's gonna be super difficult for for a very highly food motivated pet to opt out, even if the thing I'm doing is pretty yucky. And so the responsibility falls on me to make sure that I'm balancing how icky is the thing I'm asking them to do with what's the food value? And am I getting them to stick around just because I have something really good and not because they're actually comfortable with it? That's where the body language piece comes in. And then if I see a little bit of uncomfortable body language, then I actually lure them away with the food and reward them away from me so that they start to learn. If you feel uncomfortable, look elsewhere. There'll still be something for you. Please don't stick around when you're unhappy, and definitely don't come into conflict with me about it.
Yeah, my clients, I'm sure they get tired of my analogies, but I love an analogy. And I always think of staying in a job that you hate, which I have done in the past before I started doing training and setting up my business, for the money. And in the same way, a pet might stay for a really high value reward, because it's high value. But yeah, it's interesting. In terms of the benefits, what kind of benefits do you see from a veterinary perspective with animals that have had some cooperative care training.
So benefits are huge. The most basic one is that we get more accurate exam results and test results from animals who are relaxed.
Yeah.
Their blood work will be more normal. Their vital signs will be more normal. Their pain score will be more normal. And you can evaluate their physical health through examination in a way that you simply cannot if they are so, if their fear or stress level is too high. So when they've had some cooperative care training and they have that comfort with handling and with some basic procedures and an exam, the results of those exams and procedures more accurately reflect their overall health rather than reflecting their overall stress level. So, you know, we have a lot of data at this point in cats and in dogs of, for instance, their vital signs at home versus their vital signs just after riding in the car to go to the vet. And in cats, their blood pressure measurement was 30 to 50 points higher just by going to the vet's office and not having any needles or anything even done to them.
Right.
Heart rate was up to 25-30% higher.
In cats
and dogs as well, but predominantly you'll see the sight in cats. They can have changes in their white blood cell levels that are related to stress. To the extent that we see that result on the test results will come in and you'll say, oh man, look at your complete blood cell count. That's a little bit off. And say, it's a stress leukogram. And we ignore it. And that will have some change. But it's going to be actionable because it's presumed to be a stress leukogram. Or if we see dogs going forwarding or that kind of thing, and they get home and their owners call us 2 days later, say, oh, he has bloody diarrhea, I need to come in. Well, we call that stress colitis. So there's a lot of illness or signs of illness that happen just because of stress. So I believe the most valuable thing to get the ability to have an exam and the results more accurately reflect what their actual health status is.
Definitely. No, that's great. So when is the second edition of your book coming out?
So I just went under contract. So Elisa has retired. So I'm going to be the solo author for the second edition. And we just went under contract. And I am, the final draft is due in June.
Okay, brilliant.
So in about a year, the second edition should be done.
Connection.
And yeah, we're going to replace probably 3/4 of the videos will get replaced. And we're adding a couple chapters and taking one out and just tidying things up a little bit. Like any branch of science, terminology changes over time and methods change over time. So we're just going to give it a little update. And also we've, you know, had, because the educational information that's out there has prompted more interest, we've had more opportunities to train and educate, and it has let us sort of tweak a little bit how we want to present the information now that we have more feedback from students.
Nice. Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I've learned a lot, and I'm sure the listeners will as well. If you want to find out more, I really recommend getting the first edition of the book and then the second when it comes out. I obviously only read the first edition. I used it in my course actually when I had to train.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. I really liked how it was just accessible. There was no jargon. Yeah, it was really clear. That was great. But you've also got a Facebook group with lots of bits and pieces. Wow.
Yeah, our Facebook group is called Cooperative Veterinary Care. It has a little over 5,000 members at this point, and it's a really safe, supportive environment for people to come and learn about training, post their training videos, get feedback from people who have a little bit more experience than they do. It's a nice little brain trust that we have going on in the Facebook group for sure.
Brilliant. Oh, well, thanks so much, Monique. Good luck with all the videos and a new 8-week-old puppy.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, take care. Bye.
Take care.